You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, when the Golden State Killer was arrested in April, it was thanks to the help of a Florida genealogy website. We talked to a reporter about how investigators are cracking more cases with genealogy databases. Now, the opioid epidemic has been the center of focus as overdoses and deaths have been on the rise in Wisconsin and around the country. But meth use has been lurking in the shadows as much of the attention has shifted. According to a new report, there was an estimated 167% increase in people testing positive for meth as part of job-related testing throughout the Midwest, including Wisconsin. And the concern over meth has State Attorney General Brad Schimmel assigning more resources to awareness campaigns to drive down usage of the drug. Our next guest is a doctor who has worked on drug-related task forces and treated patients affected by meth and other addictive drugs. Dr. Chris Eberlein is an emergency physician at Gunderson Health System. Dr. Eberlein, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, from what you've seen in your own work and in the numbers around the state, are we seeing a big increase in the use of meth?
I think it's been there all along, at least in the numbers I've seen in our community. It's been an underlying problem. The addicts tend to change drug usage, oftentimes being depending on cost, availability, things of that nature. We have seen an increase in meth mixed with opiates, which has been a real concern around here as well. And when we review a lot of the deaths locally, we've seen meth has been kind of an underlying theme in a lot of deaths. The trick is that oftentimes meth doesn't kill you instantly like a heroin overdose or opiate overdose, but there's a strong association with the methamphetamine abuse and perhaps poor decision-making that leads to other overdoses, and that it's been a real concern, at least in our community, from the numbers I've seen, and statewide, nationwide. Meth has not left the rural communities. I think maybe it just got pushed to the side a little bit with the opiate epidemic that we're having, but it's been there all along.
When it comes to treating an addiction, as you say, we've heard a lot more about heroin and other opioid drugs. Is meth similar in terms of addiction treatment, or are there different strategies needed?
There isn't the medication-assisted treatments that we have for heroin and the opiates. So there is different strategies that have to be employed. And what I've heard from addicts and some of the people that treated it is as hard, if not more difficult, to treat someone on meth than it is on the opiates as well. So it's a substantial problem with as far as addiction goes, for sure.
Let's talk about the consequences of meth use. As you said, it doesn't have that immediate overdose death probability anyway that we see with the fentanyls and other drugs. But first, what are some of the short-term consequences of meth abuse?
Short-term, and where some people have died short-term, I don't want that to be confused. It can kill you short-term. From heart effects. Oftentimes, you know, this is a stimulant. It will cause rapid heart rate, very high blood pressures. You could have a heart attack. You can have a stroke. Long term, it hurts those same blood vessels because, you know, for so much population, we're on high blood pressure medications. We're trying to protect the blood vessels from that constant elevation in pressure. Well, these methamphetamine abusers are doing that via pill, increasing their blood pressure to dangerous levels frequently by taking that drug. So then you get that harm to those blood vessels. And it's really severe premature aging of your cardiovascular system. And then along with it, the thing that we see oftentimes in the ER, and I think a lot of people miss, is the psychosis and mental health problems that a lot of these addicts have. It's a really difficult psychosis to treat. They absolutely refuse to believe it's from the methamphetamine use, and oftentimes they're very reluctant to get treatment for it.
And as I understand it, meth use often leads to more meth use. One's tolerance of it builds up, so the same dose wouldn't affect a person at the same level, so they seek more, and people end up in this cycle maybe going on for multiple days of using it again and again to keep the influence of the meth going.
For sure. It's a very common theme that we see where they start, they get the initial high, it wears off, they get very tired because they've had that stimulation and probably been up for a long period of time at that point. and then they to function more, they take more, and then it's that vicious cycle of increasing dosing. In a way, somewhat analogous to the heroin and opiate addicts, where they keep taking more and more to try to get to that baseline.
Talking to Dr. Chris Eberlein from Gunderson Health System about meth in Wisconsin, a campaign from the Attorney General called No Meth, an ad campaign geared at prevention. And let's talk about prevention, Dr. Eberlein. It always seems like that's going to be our best bet, our most cost-effective way to deal with the problem. What do we know about prevention when it comes to meth use?
You know, unfortunately, you know, we know some, obviously, with good education, that primary prevention is very important. You know, we probably don't have as much knowledge about prevention, you know, like with opiates, where we know that 80% of heroin users started abusing prescription opiates, so we can really target those prescription opiates. We don't have that correlation yet as far as with other medications or drugs that we could look at that perhaps are playing a role. So from that standpoint, there needs to be a lot more work to be done, but clearly with knowledge of how dangerous this drug is, I think part of it, like I said before, I'm seeing a lot of opiate addicts who will offset the sleepiness they get from an opiate with methamphetamine. So it's always interesting because it seems like they're trying to get back to the baseline where they initiated all of this from, but you know, they should have just not started using in the first place, and they wouldn't be trying to get back to that baseline. But they keep overshooting the median by taking these drugs on each extreme.
So they could have this cycle where they alternate an opioid, a meth, opioid, meth, back and forth, ad infinitum.
Yep, and sometimes you even see them mix them together. So we've seen that a few times where they'll get the initial opiate sedation and high off of that, and then shortly thereafter, because the methamphetamine lasts longer, they'll end up having this extreme agitation and the opposite cycle of it, insomnia and agitation, psychosis, problems like that we see in the ER.
You mentioned addiction treatment earlier. Do we have facilities and resources for addiction treatment in Wisconsin, and do we have those facilities where the people are who need them?
There are facilities, but similar to opiate addiction, they're somewhat limited, and in fact, the inpatient treatment facilities are not always, you know, there's only a few of them in the state, so the majority of people do have to travel extended distances to get to these treatment facilities. The other thing with meth from the inpatient treatment side that I've seen, oftentimes they want them there approximately, you know, 30 days or longer. It takes that long to get someone off these off of methamphetamine. So it's a very prolonged treatment, very costly, and yes, we have too few resources as far as treatment facilities. It's oftentimes difficult to get into these facilities. They're either full, don't accept the insurance that they carry, they don't have insurance, things of that nature.
Yeah, even if somebody has insurance and wants this treatment, how common is it that insurance will cover 30 days or more of inpatient treatment?
Yeah, it can be difficult to obtain approval for and treatment for such an extended length of treatment, for sure.
Do we have success stories around the country where a community made a coordinated effort to cut back on meth use and, yeah, we saw good results? Are there places you look to for examples?
I haven't seen any great examples of a community that has had remarkable success in lowering their methamphetamine use. Like I said, it's hard to tell because oftentimes this goes in cycles. So did they just happened to get lucky and there was a downward trend to begin with. And that's part of the problem with these drugs.
Is there an overlap? You mentioned psychosis resulting from sustained prolonged meth use. Is there an overlap between a need for mental health care and addiction treatment or even addiction prevention?
Yeah, there's always an overlap. Very few of these drug addicts don't have an underlying psychiatric disorder, whether it be depression, bipolar, mania. It's almost close, you know, you can never say 100%, but the vast majority have other psychiatric illnesses that clearly play a role in their addiction habits.
And getting back to the Attorney General's campaign, this No Meth, K-N-O-W, Meth ad campaign, Is this something that you're hopeful that it'll get the word out? It'll maybe help jumpstart prevention efforts at schools and families around the state?
Yeah, we're always hopeful these prevention activities and efforts work because, like you had mentioned, it is by far the most effective, cost-effective means of controlling these illicit substances in our communities is prevention. It's very hard to treat and hard to get them out of the community once it's already there.
Dr. Eberlein, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. You have a great day.
Dr. Chris Eberlein is an emergency physician at Gunderson Health System. He joined us today to talk about meth use in Wisconsin and the impact the drug's having on people and communities around the state. While use of genealogy and genetic testing sites has exploded in the general population, it's also caught the interest of a group that may not be the first to come to mind. Law enforcement and criminal investigators have begun to use genealogy website databases to find potential suspects. And in the case of the so-called Golden State Killer in California, make an arrest. Megan Multeny is a staff writer at Wired, where she covers biology, health, technology, and the environment. She's been writing about the use of genealogy sites and solving cold cases like California's murderer and rapist known as the Golden State Killer. Megan, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks. Good to be here.
Well, a lot more people are using these sites, but not everybody is, Megan. So talk us, for people who are unfamiliar, how do these things work?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, genealogy has been around for a lot longer than we've had genetic testing. So we're talking about, you know, people who make family trees using census records and birth and death certificates and obituaries. But in the last 5 years or so, as DNA sequencing technologies have become less expensive, genetic ancestry tests have become, you know, very widely available to the average consumer. So, you know, the companies that do this kind of testing, you know, the big ones are 23andMe and Ancestry. There's also MyHeritage and Family Tree DNA, and they all basically work the same way. You send in your spit. They, you know, take that saliva, they crack open the cells in there, they pull out the DNA, and they put together a map of about 600,000, more or less, places in your genome. And because of how inheritance works, you know, some of that DNA came from your mom, some came from your dad, and then on back and back kind of in time. And it turns out that you can actually look at the number and the size of the kind of shared DNA between people and figure out how related two people are. And, you know, that math gets easier the more people are in the database. So essentially, you know, these kinds of commercial services will tell you, you know, based on who's in their database, who you might be related to. You know, so those aren't the sites that law enforcement are using at this time because you need a warrant to access those. They're private databases, but those companies also provide a service where you can download your genetic profile, those raw data files, and then you can upload them to publicly available third-party websites. And so that's the one that law enforcement have started to become attracted to. And so that's the big one is one called GED Match or GED Match. And that's the one that was actually involved in the Golden State Killer case.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So there's this sort of voluntary thing. If you've done these genetic testing, you can load yourself up to this GED Match. How did police use this to ultimately catch the so-called Golden State Killer?
Sure. Yeah. So they, you know, they had DNA evidence from that cold case, you know, going back for decades that they had run through the traditional forensic databases, hadn't turned up any matches, which just meant that, you know, this person had not ever come into contact with law enforcement before. And so what they did was they, you know, took a genetic profile that they derived from that evidence, they uploaded it into GEDmatch, and then they worked with a genealogist to look at the matches that came out of that. And they basically found a third cousin, which is on the farther end of kind of where you can work from, because there's not that much genetic similarity at that point. But working with that genealogist, they were able to, you know, they kind of had a family name at that point. And then they were able to narrow it down using, you know, genealogy records, but also using kind of police work to figure out, get down to an individual who kind of matched the profile of the Golden State Killer, so lived in the right places in California at about the right time, and eventually came up with the name of a suspect who was still living in California. And at that point, detectives underwent surveillance of the individual, whose name is Joseph James DeAngelo. They eventually staked out his house, got, you know, some DNA evidence that was discarded from his property and ran that against, you know, against a DNA match and found that he was a match to the old crime scene evidence. And that was the point at which they made the arrest.
Now, this raises questions for people involved in GEDmatch and the people who upload their data. There are a lot of things they may be hoping to do with their genetic data. Probably helping catch criminals wasn't at the top of their mind. What kind of reaction did this get?
Yeah, I mean, initially it was pretty mixed. I think people who use GEDmatch, it's a lot of hobbyist genealogists. You know, there are about 100,000 people. Excuse me, if that's incorrect. There are about a million, just over 950,000 people who were on GEDmatch at the time that news broke. And initially, a number of people did pull their profiles or privatize them, make them not available to use. But in the days afterward, you know, as kind of the genealogy crowd grappled with what this meant, the number of people uploading profiles began to tick back up. I think people wanted their DNA to be used for good, you know, and especially with such a high profile case, you know, this was obviously a big win to provide some closure for all the families affected by the Golden State Killer. So kind of in the aftermath of that, the two individuals who run GEDmatch essentially changed the terms and conditions for the website. So it now explicitly says that GEDmatch is used by law enforcement individuals. That is something that you have to acknowledge and accept before you can, you know, log back in. And it also added an additional feature where when you're uploading a profile, you have to say kind of whether it's your own DNA or someone, you know, else's DNA who you have explicit permission for, or if you're a law enforcement agency. And the only two conditions on which they explicitly allow it in the terms and conditions is if that individual is a suspect in a violent crime, so a rape or a murder, or if it's to identify unidentified remains.
Talking to Megan Multeny from Wired, talking about the use of a genetic testing or a genetic matching website for criminal investigations. And Megan, now since all of that happened after the apprehension of the Golden State Killer, are they doing this now? Are police working with GEDmatch and finding criminals in cold cases?
Yeah, so far they're not working with them directly. There is a forensic firm called Parabon Nanolabs that essentially specializes in a service called DNA phenotyping. So they'll take DNA from a crime scene and they will create a kind of facial composite of what they think that suspect looks like. So that was a service they already provided. They had about 100 genetic profiles already on file from police and investigators around the country, kind of involved in cold cases. And so essentially what they did was they asked all of those police departments, hey, do you want us to run this through GEDmatch, you know, instead and see if we get any hits? It's part of a new service they announced May 8th. It's called their Genetic Genealogy Unit. It's actually being headed up by a kind of famous genealogist named C.C. Moore. And so essentially from that point, as soon as they're getting permissions from police departments, they're uploading that to GEDmatch. They're seeing what's turning up. So far, they've had about 20 of those 100 profiles. They've had 20 that seem like there will be some promising future work that can be hashed out with their genealogists, and about 30 others that are, you know, maybe potentially going to turn up some hits. And then about 50% that, you know, there's no one in the database right now that turns up a match, but that may change over time as people upload new profiles.
So some obvious upside there in the sense of solving, in some cases, heinous crimes. Are people raising downside concerns, worries about privacy or misuse of this kind of information?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's actually, the first problem is that there's a big misconception out there that, you know, that people who've submitted their spit to 23andMe and Ancestry, that police are working directly with those databases. And so that's, you know, the first thing is dispelling kind of that misconception. That's, you know, that's not true. Those companies require a warrant from a police department to turn over information, and they actually haven't yet ever turned over any genetic information to law enforcement kind of based on their own reporting. So, you know, these are people who are voluntarily uploading their genetic profiles, and they are acknowledging the risks and how it might be used by law enforcement. But the big concern is that, you know, your DNA isn't just yours. Mm-hmm. That's just how heredity works. So the tension is that any sample that gets uploaded is also providing information that could lead to relatives that haven't consented to have their information made public, and they might not even know that's been done. So I might choose to accept the risk for myself after reading the terms and conditions. But by uploading my information, I can kind of quickly create this genetic dragnet that implicates a lot of people I'm related to who haven't knowingly made a decision to participate. And so that really gets into some strange gray areas as far as privacy is concerned.
We are very literally in early days here, right? Because you said they just made some of these policies last month. Is this just the tip of the iceberg? Are we going to see a lot more use or attempted use of this kind of genetic information in crime solving?
I think so. I mean, things seem like they're moving very quickly. Essentially, the Golden State Killer news kind of cracked this open, and it made both law enforcement and the genealogy community aware that this was a potential use. You know, Parabon launched their service just days later. There was already a second case that they solved. So it was a double murder up in Snohomish County, Washington, dating back a couple of decades. And I believe it was like a Friday night that Parabon Nanolabs uploaded the crime scene evidence to GEDmatch, and CC Moore, their genealogist, worked on it over the weekend. And basically by Monday, was able to take, she had two matches from second cousins on opposite sides of the family tree. So it was a much more straightforward case than the Golden State Killer. So essentially those two cousins had to be joined by a marriage, and it turned out that the product of that marriage was just a single only child. It was a son. And so basically it took a weekend to go from a DNA sample to providing the police with a name, and an arrest was made later that week. So I do think that, you know, there is a real excitement from the law enforcement community that this.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Megan Multeni, staff writer at Wired, talking about genetic testing and matching and police investigations. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. The Democratic National Committee was the subject of a lot of criticism in the 2016 presidential election. One of the big sticking points is the role of superdelegates. Those are party insiders who play a role in the presidential and vice presidential nomination process. Here's then presidential candidate Senator Bernie Sanders criticizing Hillary Clinton's early hold on superdelegates at a rally 2 years ago.
The establishment determined who the anointed candidate will be before the first voters got into the process. I think that that is a very, very bad idea. And it's an idea that we intend to change at the convention.
Tomorrow, the Democratic National Committee is expected to change that system. Barry Burden is a professor of political science at UW-Madison and director of the UW's Elections Research Center. He's with us now to talk about what a change could mean for the party and its nomination process. Barry, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be here.
Well, flesh out the role of the superdelegate. How does that work presently?
Well, it's a unique character of the Democratic Party. Republicans have really resisted doing this. It dates back to the early 1980s and was really a reaction to what happened in the 1980 Democratic nomination battle, where Jimmy Carter, who was a sitting president running for re-election, presumably would have few opponents, but he had a serious opponent in Senator Ted Kennedy, who took it all the way to the convention. And there was some concern that maybe Democrats had opened up the process a little too much in the reforms of the 1960s and allowed a lot of party outsiders to come in and influence the process. And so to exert a little more control from party establishment figures, they created what we call superdelegates, what they call PLEOs. These are party leaders and elected officials, combination of members of Congress, governors, presidents, and members of the Democratic National Committee, who now make up about 15% of the delegates to the national convention.
And how did they play out in this last, the 2016 Democratic primary campaign? Were they a swing vote?
They were a factor, but I would say more of a psychological factor than a decisive one. And that was true back in 2008, too, when Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were fighting it out for the nomination. The PLEOs, these superdelegates, are not pledged to a candidate, and they can change their preference at any point. But many of them choose to announce who they're for early on and try to build some momentum for the candidate. In both 2008 and 2016, Hillary Clinton racked up a lot of endorsements from the superdelegates before any voting happened place. So that's exactly what Sanders was saying in the clip. But those endorsements don't mean anything in a real sense till you get to the convention where they can change their votes and there's horse trading and everything else. In the end, the superdelegates were with Clinton, but so were the regular delegates. She won majorities of both of those groups.
And the goal here, it's kind of like a ballast to keep, as you said, somebody coming from outside the party. And in this last election, we saw Senator Sanders, not technically a Democrat, running for the Democratic nomination. We saw Donald Trump, not really a Republican elected official, coming in from the outside. Maybe superdelegates worked as designed for the Democrats and Republicans didn't have that. So they got a candidate that for most of the campaign they didn't want.
Yeah, it's a little surprising. So Democrats like to reform their process. This is what Democrats are good at doing. They run an election, something goes wrong, they appoint a commission to try to fix it. So there have been a series of commissions over the years, including the one that created superdelegates. The commission that's operating now is trying to figure out what happened in 2016 to set them on the wrong path. And Republicans have resisted this kind of tinkering with the process at a time when you might think they would be interested in doing so because they had an outsider come in and really take over the nomination in Donald Trump. Even when a lot of Republican insiders were not for him, they were for other candidates or for no candidates. And the Democrats mostly got the candidate you would have expected, the experienced Democrat who had come up through the party, had run for president once before. So I think it's something about the culture of the parties that the Dems like to muck around in this area and Republicans sort of let it ride.
Talking to Barry Burton from UW, he's head of the UW's Election Research Center, looking at possible changes to the superdelegate system in the Democratic primary. What kind of changes are they talking about? It looks like a range of possible solutions here.
Yeah, we don't know what will come out of these meetings, but we know that the Sanders movement within the party has really pushed to do away with superdelegates altogether. He and his followers, many of them view them as undemocratic, as a way to keep out interesting people and interesting ideas from coming in and keeping the party innovative and fresh and competitive. But there are lots of Democrats who like to hold on to those delegates, including the people who are those delegates. Members of Congress in particular, governors, former presidents, all Democrats would be delegates. So I think there are a couple things that might emerge. The most radical idea would be to do away with superdelegates. I don't think that's happening. What they might do instead is either reduce the number of delegates who are in this category, maybe taking off the table the DNC members who are part of that group, or only letting the superdelegates vote in the second round at the convention if a candidate doesn't win a majority of the vote on the first round. That seems like an unlikely possibility. It's rare that convention votes go to a second ballot, even at the more controversial Republican convention in 2016. That didn't happen.
That used to happen all the time, right? There'd be dozens, in some cases, of votes at a convention. The parties have really changed things, it seems, so that they come in and you know who the presidential nominee is going to be.
That's right. Before about the 1960s, conventions were the place where the nominee got decided because delegates came from states, often appointed by party bosses. They had different ideas about what the party ought to be about, and they would fight it out on the convention floor as late as 1968, famously, that Democratic convention in Chicago. But nowadays, conventions are mostly coronations that wrap up a very long season of delegate selection through primaries and caucuses. So it's sort of the end of a process rather than the kickoff to a new one.
How much of this is a PR issue, maybe more than a practical issue for Democrats? Because between superdelegates and some other issues, emails that came out via WikiLeaks and elsewhere, this perception that Democratic insiders were trying to put their finger on the scale.
Yeah, I think that's part of the larger argument that's going on. Again, particularly from the Sanders supporters, many of whom were not really part of the Democratic Party or didn't come up through politics that way. They're concerned about a whole range of things. One of the other issues for them are closed primaries that only allow registered partisans to participate. Sanders did better in open primaries often than he did in closed primaries, and they feel as though that's an anti-democratic law or rule, and so they'd like to see that change along with some changes at the convention.
There's sort of a base philosophy of what is a party at work here, right? Is the party people who are card-carrying members of that party who show up to committee meetings, or is it open to like-minded-ish people from the general public?
Yeah, imagine the most extreme form of that, where a party says, we're going to settle the nomination by a vote on the internet. Anyone who registers on our website can do it. I don't think we would think of that as a party. That might be an interesting process, but those are people who don't necessarily have a long-term attachment to the party, haven't invested. And so the superdelegates are a way to keep the balance between the newcomers who have gotten excited by a particular round of an election and people who have a longer-term attachment to the party.
But is some level of openness maybe a way for a party to try to bring new blood in? Maybe that the Sanders supporters, if they had felt included, might have been a big boon for the Democratic Party, say.
Boy, it's hard to game these things out. And this is where I think the Democrats get themselves in trouble in a way that Republicans don't. They're always rethinking the last battle and what could we do differently. Barack Obama was an outsider, frankly, when he won the nomination, had barely been in public office, had not spent a lot of time in the party, and yet defeated Hillary Clinton in that battle. I think it's hard to say exactly how the rules play out in a particular circumstance.
We're talking to Barry Burden, professor of political science at UW-Madison, director of the UW's Elections Research Center. We're talking about super delegates and a plan from the DNC to potentially scale back their influence at a meeting tomorrow. I want to know what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see changes for the Democrats to the super delegate system? Do you think presidential and vice presidential nominating process, it should be as close to a direct election as possible? Or do you think that there's a reason to have party officials, elected officials, to have that that vote that they can make at the convention? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. We're talking about superdelegates and a potential change being considered by the DNC that would reduce the role of superdelegates, maybe get rid of it, sounds like probably not, in the presidential nomination process. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the two major parties are responsive enough to voters, especially in the presidential nomination process? What do you think of how Republicans do it versus Democrats? And what do you think about this issue of superdelegates? Should Democrats have them? Should either party have them? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. To your calls now, Andrew is with us in Green Bay. Andrew, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you think?
I was just wondering if it would ever be an option for superdelegates to not be allowed to publicly endorse or stump for a candidate until after their particular state's election or primary election.
Andrew, thanks for the call. I don't know if that particular restriction is in the works, but it's an interesting thought to say, okay, they can do this, but they don't have that pre-voting influence.
Yeah, Andrew's not alone in thinking about that idea. Some members of Congress have actually voluntarily decided not to endorse a candidate until the primary or caucus happens in their state. Sometimes that's an act of courage. Sometimes that's waiting to see how the votes come out so they don't end up on the wrong side of things. I think our own congressional representative here in the Madison area, Mark Pocan, did that around the Wisconsin primary back in 2016.
Thanks for that call. I will go now to another Andrew in Stevens Point. Andrew, hi.
Yes, another Andrew Stevens point. Thank you. Yeah, I believe that the superdelegate system is really a blow to the will of the people, and I think it's a preemptive choice that doesn't have a backing.
Andrew, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. A lot of people felt that way on the Democratics, on the Bernie Sanders side of things in particular during that last election.
Yeah, and this second Andrew's right. It's not Democratic, small d Democratic. But I think party officials would say that's sort of the point, that they want to retain some control over the process, keep out really unelectable figures or candidates who maybe don't fit with the party platform or the image they want to convey. So I think there's always a balancing act for a party to be permeable and open and flexible, but also to maintain its integrity as a party and have some consistency in what it stands for from one election to the next.
I've heard some analysis saying that the role of the party as an organization has declined in the United States over the years. Do you see that, especially as it comes to selecting a presidential candidate?
Yeah, that's generally been the pattern. I think it's complicated what's happened over time, but parties as structures have sort of weakened. The internet has done some of that, and social media and other ways for people to communicate, raise money, join organizations in a more horizontal and democratic fashion than parties traditionally have operated. But they have a role to play. And really, the national nominating conventions are the last bastion of what a party stands for. If they don't have a role there, you wonder what they do.
Thanks a lot for that call. Andrew at 800-642-1234. Is there room for a comeback of the party as a kind of a mass organization where people think they define themselves as, say, a Democrat or a Republican, not just I vote that way in elections, but I am a member, a participating member of this organization?
Well, what we have seen an increase in is the number of people giving to political parties and campaigns. That has been on the rise for the last 10 or 15 years or so. So there are more people tapped into parties that way, and that's about as close as we get to party membership in the U.S. A lot of states have party registration, so that Wisconsin doesn't, but many others do, and so that's a way that people might identify themselves in an official way with a party in the U.S. It doesn't go much further than that.
Let's bring on another caller now. Mary is with us in Jefferson. Mary, hi.
Hi. My question is, if the Republicans would have met superdelegates, would it have kept, do you think it would have kept Donald Trump off of the ticket? Because if that would be possible, then I would say keep the superdelegates in the Democratic Party.
Mary, thanks for the call. It's a kind of a counterfactual because they didn't. But if Republicans did things the way Democrats did, how might that have affected the 2016 Republican primary campaign?
It's a terrific question. We'll never know the answer. I mean, one clue is to look at what other Republican officials did during that primary season. And these are people who would have been superdelegates had the party had them. Most of them chose not to endorse anyone. So they didn't line up behind Rubio or Walker or Jeb Bush. They mostly waited it out. And I think maybe the size of the field, there were 16 or 17 candidates at some point, prevented that. Some Democrats are now talking about a reason to keep superdelegates is to prevent an outsider like Trump coming in and grabbing the nomination in an unpredictable nomination season.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mary. On the other hand, one party did retain a little more control over their nomination process. The other one didn't. Which one won?
That's right. Yeah, that's why I say it's hard to game these things out. We know what the rules are, but the rules are really, their effects at least, are really dependent on what the field of candidates look like. I think a Democratic contest between two candidates, Clinton and Sanders, would have turned out very differently had it been Clinton versus 16 other Democrats. Mm-hmm. Then I think we wouldn't be talking about superdelegates in the same way we are today.
Yeah, Democrats likely to make some kind of changes tomorrow. And as you said, they tend to be more prone to tinker with their process. Is this something that in 4 or 20 years, they'll probably be looking back and saying, oh, no, we made a big mistake?
Well, I expect to be on the program in 20 years or so and talk about what the latest commission is. And yeah, there's not an ideal solution here. No matter what you do, you'll be offending some members of the party and making others happy. It's a zero-sum game, some gain and some lose. Today, it's really the members of Congress who are unhappy that they might have their role as automatic delegates taken away. But you lose that and you gain some newcomers to the party, potentially.
I want to spend our last few moments on a tangent. I talked to you about this before the show. I surprised people on the air the other day by saying gerrymandering, not gerrymandering. I'd seen a pretty convincing Wall Street Journal article that that's the right way, and the article quoted a UW professor named Barry Burden.
That's right. I think it's the right pronunciation. It's a term, maybe unflatteringly, named after a person who was governor of Massachusetts and a signer of the Declaration of Independence and a vice presidential candidate and a bunch of other things. Maybe his family wouldn't like him to be known for this, but it is his name. And the original term was the idea of merging his surname with a picture of a salamander in the original drawn district. Some of you have probably seen that was the gerrymander. You know, we're not going to force this on people, but I think it's the right pronunciation. I'm glad Rob is on board.
I am on board with this. Barry, no berrymandering, though. Barry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That's Barry Burden, professor of political science at UW-Madison and director of the UW's Elections Research Center, with us to talk about potential changes to the superdelegate system up for a committee vote tomorrow at the Democratic National Committee. Democratic candidate for governor Mike McCabe has inspired and sometimes frustrated Democrats across the state with his people before party message. As part of our ongoing series on the 2018 governor's race, Laurel White has this profile of the candidate who says he'd call himself Governor Blue Jeans.
Cars are speeding by on a busy street in Madison. Three people, two middle-aged men and one young woman, are standing on a street corner holding posters.
My name is Sarah Wilson, and I'm out here holding my people-powered billboard sign.
Wilson says people-powered billboards have been a big part of Democratic candidate Mike McCabe's campaign for governor. She says supporters are making McCabe posters and standing on street corners and sidewalks all across Wisconsin.
Because we're not taking big money donations, it really has to be a group of volunteers going out talking to people instead of just sending out mailers or, you know, putting on ads or whatever. It has to be person to person.
Another volunteer, Alice Schneiderman, says she feels like she really knows McCabe, and she's never felt that way about a politician before.
I feel like I can go up and hug Mike and his wife, Marilyn. I mean, when does that happen?
Schneiderman says she appreciates that McCabe won't take big campaign contributions. McCabe says that's a big part of his campaign philosophy. He won't take any single campaign donation over $200. No money from big donors or PACs.
All the work I've done over the course of virtually my entire adult life has shown me that there are strings attached to those checks.
McCabe helped launch the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, a group that tracks money in politics. For years, he was the go-to guy in the state for information about financial misdeeds by politicians of either party. Now he says it's time to practice what he preached.
This is an opportunity to replace all that money power with people power.
McCabe works to portray himself as a man of the people. His campaign committee is called Commoners for McCabe. He's written a book and advised other candidates under the umbrella of a group he calls Blue Jean Nation. There's a theme song for the group, a take on an old Neil Diamond song performed here by Peter Leidy.
And since the powers that be just won't see, we'd much rather be a nation in blue jeans.
Nancy Unger is a professor of history at Santa Clara University. She's written books about Bob and Belle La Follette, two iconic figures in Wisconsin politics. Unger says Mike McCabe has a lot in common with La Follette because they both push the message of regular people taking charge of politics.
I think Mike McCabe is really echoing this notion that if you don't like the system, then you have to change it. You can't just wait for political leaders to change it. You have to work with them to do that.
Some people are obviously excited about McCabe, but there are others who have major concerns. McCabe has worked for Republicans in the past and won't promise that he'll endorse the eventual Democratic nominee for governor if it's not him. Scott Ross is the executive director of One Wisconsin Now, a liberal advocacy group.
I think it undermines the credibility of the person who's asking people for votes as a Democrat who says they're not willing to support the Democratic nominee.
McCabe says he doesn't agree with the idea of saying any member of the Democratic Party is better than Scott Walker. Ross says that's a problem.
Because I don't care who gets out of the primary, they are all in a different solar system in terms of how lousy Scott Walker is and what a disaster it would be for him to be governor 4 more years.
But McCabe says it's disrespectful to voters to say candidates are interchangeable as long as they have a D behind their name. He wants people to, quote, feel really good about casting a ballot for a change. And voting for him, he hopes, will do that. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the Trump administration is looking at a major overhaul of the federal agencies that provide public assistance. We'll find out what would change and what would go into making that change. The creator of an insect zoo is going to bring his menagerie into the studio with us. Hopefully not let them loose. We'll get a look at them and talk about his work educating kids and getting them inspired about science. And in this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll cook up some flavor bombs. Our guest shares surprising ingredients that can add a whole new level to everything from burgers to desserts. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.